The Tom Flowers Cricket Coaching Podcast, brought to you by Bespoke Cricket, Rutland's premium cricket brand. For the best bats, pads and gloves, check out bespoke-cricket.co.uk. Here's what's coming up on the podcast.
And, you know, I hold a lot of that accountable with the way the academy director at Leicestershire at the time, you know, his level of empathy and people skills, you know, was reminiscent of sort of a wooden spoon, really. I mean, he, and that wasn't just my opinion. Mentally, I was just absolutely cooked. And, you know, you've got to bear in mind, this is a period of time where things like mental health, which it later turned out that I'd been suffering with at the time, that was unheard of. It was untalked about.
Now, on with the podcast.
So, Tom, let's start from the beginning. What are your first memories of cricket?
My first memories of cricket are age of sort of 2-3 years old, I guess. Probably old school in the sense that my dad played. His dad was interested in cricket. My uncle played. So very much a family affair. Was around a bat and a ball from the age of sort of two. I think there's photos of me 2-3 years old upwards. So yeah, really, it was a way of life for me. Cricket was from a young age. First memory is watching my dad, but then sort of being asked to go and train with under-13s, I think, for my first session. I was sort of 6 years old, 7 years old, and from there, really, sort of got the cricketing bug, I guess you could say.
And would you say that it's your dad that got you into cricket, or were there any other family members involved?
Yeah, definitely dad was my big influence cricketing-wise. Mum was a big support. I mean, Crum's mum used to throw balls at us, etc. But my dad, without my dad, I wouldn't have been around cricket. I always compare it to like motor racing these days. I think it's a very specific niche sport. If you're not surrounded by it or have a passionate parent, it's something you never really get into. And I think that's cricket all over, really. So was very fortunate that my dad introduced me to my local cricket club, which was Barkby United Cricket Club, from a young age.
Oh, so yeah, that's going to be my next question, what your first club was. So do you want to tell us a bit more about Barkby, what it was like?
So Barkby was a real shaping club for me, both on a junior front when it came to things like standards. And, you know, we had old school coaches. You had to tuck your shirts in. You could only train in whites. You got sent home if you didn't wear whites. I mean, could you imagine that now? what the backlash would be from online, for example. But you know what? It really taught us good values, and it taught us a discipline. And I think that they're skills that I've hopefully taken through the rest of my cricket career, into my coaching, and also into wider life as well. So Barkby is very much a family orientated club, prided itself on homegrown players, real club, unique club, with a real family ethos, and, you know, club that has had generations of the same sort of families that have come through it. So yeah, very, very grateful to the start that Barkby gave me as a cricket club.
So you must have had plenty of idols at Barkby itself, but did you have any sort of cricketing idols from the international stage that you used to watch on TV?
I think with myself growing up at Leicester, it was in the early days, sort of Darren Maddy. He was sort of classic, really, Leicester lad. It's the sort of local hero story, really. I sort of based him off the way that I played and the way I viewed the game on how he operated. Obviously, he went on to play a test match for England, which was great. But in the latter years, it became sort of Paul Nixon, purely for his professionalism and the way he went about the game. And then I'm fortunate I've still kept in touch with Paul, even to this day on the coaching front. And he was very much a key influence and mentor in the early days for me as a player.
Yes, talk to me a bit about you as a player. Are you primarily a batter, and if you do bowl, what do you bowl?
Yeah, so I mean, I retired 5-6 years ago now. Was an opening batter. I guess you'd say in my early years, quite a traditional batter. Went to the Championship cricket, longer format was prioritised. When I was coming through, it was only really sort of T20 at the top end that had been influenced. You didn't really have sort of county age groups playing T20s. It hadn't filtered down. The T20 blast was still a bit of a novelty, whereas obviously now, you know, if you're on the academy systems and coming through, it's a part of white ball cricket. Short form 50 over 20 over is expected to be part of your cricketing toolbox, I guess, really. So mainly a batter, bowled a little bit of off spin up to sort of league Premier League level, but yeah, batting was my sort of main forte. And then as I got a bit older, I became more of a sort of hard hitting opening batter. When you had the introductions of, you know, more white ball games as I got into my late teens, and restrictions, so it sort of favoured hard hitting, good techniques, I guess, really batting at the top of the order.
So you mentioned Leicestershire there, and I know that you were in Leicestershire twos for a while. Talk to me a little bit about what that experience was like for you.
So I was very lucky, being involved, I guess, from a young age. So I think I had my first song in the academy at Leicester at 13. So it was the first ever intake of an academy, which was good in some ways, because it was a real, on paper, it meant that they were sort of backing you. The reality was very different, I guess, because it was very much a prototype. And I don't know how it was done at other counties. I guess a lot of coaches are finding their way through that. But we were sort of the prototype years or intake. But I guess with that, the old school mentality is still there a little bit. So, you know, I got exposed to my first indoor net with the pros at 14, which was great. I remember coming off of school to go and do that. And then made my twos debut, I think, 15, 16, which again, as a young batter these days, is, I won't say it's unheard of, but it's less common. So that was great as well. I then spent six seasons around the twos at Leicester. We made the first team squad three times, never got a gig, which is one of them. The learning experience and the players that, as I say, it was more that old school era. So you had guys who were, they'd come and play the 3 day games in twos cricket, because there wasn't the demand of the white ball stuff. So they weren't being rested, or they weren't in another competition at the same time alongside it. It was very much, if you're not picked in the ones during the long format, you're playing in the twos. So it was great to sort of catch the back end of some ex-test match players like Jeremy Snape, well, one day player Jeremy Snape, Aftab Habib, Phil De Freitas, as I say, Paul Nixon, international cricketer. I got to play with and share a change room with these guys, which again now is something the youngsters probably don't get. So yeah, got to 21, did well, but never really got that opportunity, and obviously they just didn't quite back me enough, and probably didn't think I was quite good enough, probably didn't score enough hundreds looking back at it. But equally, it's a different era now. You know, if you went and scored 30 in the second team as a 16-year-old, it's all over social media, it's all over play cricket. It's a different world. I think that's a really great thing, and it's a great platform for the youngsters today. The other big difference now, I guess, is that there's not the same push on the with the cold pack situation of players, whereas at Leicester we had numerous cold pack players. And now, which is a great thing, is the under 25 bonuses. So if you've got a homegrown English qualified under 25 player, the counties get a kickback financially, and I think that's a great initiative. So look, came out of the game early at 21, was determined not to sort of be on that pile of players that at 26, 27 get released, which I could easily have been in that situation if I carried on pursuing that career. And was able to get ahead in coaching. So that was, you know, things happen for a reason. And I think that was a blessing long term, really, because 37 now and I've been coaching 16 full years, which is fantastic in my opinion of where things were at. So,
yeah, absolutely. And we'll get into your retirement decision and your coaching in just a couple of minutes. I've just got a couple more questions about the playing days. You spoke about some of the great players that you played with. Can you remember the toughest bowler that you ever faced while playing for Leicestershire? Is there any famous faces in there?
Toughest bowler. I mean, the problem we had at Leicester is I think most of the toughest bowlers would probably play for us, because I had Stuart Broad, obviously he goes without saying his record, Harry Gurney, who played for England for a number of years, left-arm bowler. You know, you had Phil De Freitas at the back end of his career. We had Otis Gibson, who was West Indian cricketer. So, yeah, I'm Claude Henderson, South African international spinner. So the funny thing was, is I often felt I was probably more tested in our own sessions than I was opposition-wise, if that sort of makes any sense. But I remember a Yorkshire attack that included Adil Rashid, Tim Bresnan, Ajmal Shezad, and a guy called David Wainwright. I think he played Yorkshire at England A, I think, or he was around that sort of Lions team. That was quite a steady bowling attack, I think, to come up against. So probably played against more names, I'd say, when I was out in Australia, when I was playing grade cricket over there. Ben Hilfenhaus was on the circuit there. Xavier Doherty, Australian spinner. A guy called Brendan Drew, who was pretty sharp. Pleasure playing against Tim Payne was out there as well, James Faulkner. So it was that. I mean, that was, yeah, the way the Aussie system works, that was a real eye-opener when I went away to Australia the year before finishing at Leicester. I hope that sort of answers the question, really. Tough one.
Do you have a favourite individual achievement as a player?
Yeah, I think making my first class debut when I was at Loughborough University Centre of Excellence was a real achievement because that's meant that I felt I got the recognition I deserved for, you know, I knew at that point, whatever happens, that I can say I played first class cricket, which is something I knew I was good enough to do. But I wanted that sort of, I got approval, whatever you might call it. But when you feel you've not had that backing necessarily from your own county, it was nice to sort of get that through my university scheme. So yeah, making my first class debut at the Oval against Surrey was pretty cool. And that's something I probably won't forget.
You alluded to it a little bit before with the play cricket and stuff, but with how the landscape has changed in the years since you retired, do you think that in the modern game you might have been more likely to get a professional contract with a county?
I'd still probably need to score more hundreds, but I do think that, yes, 100%. I mean, I look at some of the innings that I played as a 17-year-old probably in the second team. Like that, I've seen guys get 70 in the twos since then, and it goes viral over the social media, etc. So I do think that exposure for youngsters now, I can't speak for whether it would have given me a better platform, who knows, but I 100% can say that for a 16, 17-year-old batter now, if you, every game's almost a shot to nothing in the sense that every game's filmed, every game's on streaming, every game's, so if you do well, when you know, you're not expected to dominate at 16, 17 in the twos or 18, but if you do well, it is a shot to nothing in the sense that overnight you could, I mean, if you go and smash a 50 ball 100 as a 17-year-old in a one day twos game, you are going to be going viral that night. And I think that's quite an exciting landscape that the game is at, because you're not probably going to get missed that way. What I would say is that can also add other pressures. And I guess coming full circle to answer that, one of the reasons, and I was having this chat with another guy who played first class cricket only this week, who's retired, he's not playing first class cricket, he's playing for a club side still, Premier League cricket, and he's played a lot of first class cricket. And, you know, I was just saying about, I don't miss, in the early days of starting the coaching business, I don't miss, you know, your clients or your players checking in on you and how you did it a weekend, because that's meant to be your downtime. That's now no longer a job or an income. That is, it's not a career. It's what you're doing in your social time. And I do think there is a different type of pressure now on guys that are exiting the game or retiring or moving careers or whatever, because you almost feel that cricket is a game of numbers and it doesn't tell the true picture. And I certainly feel, and maybe it's just me, but I would feel quite a pressure now, I think, knowing that you're going to be judged as a cricketer, even at 37, which is probably in my head, but with things like play cricket and all the stats that are available at the click of a button. So hopefully that sort of gives you an insight into that.
Yeah, definitely. So you've already mentioned sort of some of the reasons why you chose to call time in your career and go into coaching, and you've also said that you're happy that you did and it's worked out very well for you. But was it a difficult decision at the time? And also, how did you know that you wanted to be a coach?
I've always come back to this view that you make the best decision you can at the time with all the information and options available. And I was pretty downtrodden and beaten, and I did not, you can only take sort of rejection and a lack of backing and And you know, I hold a lot of that accountable with the way sort of the academy director at Leicestershire at the time, you know, his level of empathy and people skills, you know, was reminiscent of sort of a wooden spoon, really. I mean, he and that wasn't just my opinion, but I think when you're a player who needs a bit of nurturing and a bit of an arm around or a bit of confidence giving, that's something that I didn't have at the time, and that you can only take that, I think, for so long if you're that type of player. I probably wasn't tough enough mentally to give myself that kind of talking to. So, but equally, there's been some great players who have needed close managing, who coaches haven't given up on. But I do think that getting to that decision was tough at the time. But it was also a reflection, I guess, of my character, which is right. Okay, so my overriding view was I was determined two things. I was determined to make sure that my next stage of my career, I made it work and put all my efforts that I had in my mindset from my cricket into that. I also said to myself that I don't owe cricket anything, and because of that, going in down the coaching route and later the coaching business route, there have been times where I've questioned myself, other people have questioned it, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, that's not the way things are done. And I think it's really helped with that mindset, that sort of stubborn, ruthless mindset I've had, certainly with the business side of it, which has been, well, I'm going to make this work, and you know, cricket, you know, I don't owe the game anything with the time I've put in, and sort of this is sort of payback time, if that makes sense. So yeah, tough decision. I had a six-week trial at Warwickshire lined up when I left Leicester, but mentally I was just absolutely cooked. And you know, you've got to bear in mind this is a period of time where things like mental health, which it later turned out that I'd been suffering with at the time, that was unheard of. It was untalked about. It was very few and far between players who had come to spoken up about that, never mind having a support network trickling down through counties, first 11, second 11's academy. It just was unheard of. So maybe come back to your earlier question, the awareness and support that for mental health now would have definitely helped me at the time. Equally, when you it is as ruthless as it comes. The day I walked away at Leicestershire, that last game of the season at 21, I have had zero contact from any of the coaches from that point onwards. And I think that's well publicised in football, in rugby, in cricket, in academies where, you know, it is that ruthless. When you are deemed surplus to requirements and no longer part of something, they move on, and quite rightly, and it's the next people that get their attention and time. So there is no exit strategy with these county cricket clubs. The PCA do a great job, but ultimately that can be quite tough having to navigate your way through the landscape after you leave the county game. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that's really tough. And obviously, the thing with professional sports is that it's not just the players who call time early that have to figure out what they're going to do with the rest of their lives. It's, you know, even if you play till you're 40, that's still only half your life, and you might not have actually made enough money yet to sort of retire and sail off into the sunset. Do you want to just tell us a bit about how your coaching career began? What were the first jobs you took?
Yeah, so I often get asked this, and I think that, in short, the first jobs you take are any coaching that you can get. I mean, I was doing one-to-one coaching for £6, £7 an hour way back in the day when I was sort of 18. So I was coaching. I didn't realise, but I was actually setting up my second career from the age of 17, 18 when I was work. I felt that I really enjoyed coaching. I really enjoyed, because I was quite an analyser of the game. I enjoyed talking about the game. I enjoyed chewing the fat, sharing knowledge, and I guess it sort of grew from there, really. I ran my own little academy while I was at university. I ran holiday camps, one-to-ones, and then got my qualification. And then I left university at Loughborough in a mindset that, right, I'm not pursuing the cricketing career anymore. And I got offered a job at as head of cricket in independent school, which was a huge, huge offer. in the sense that not necessarily financially, but for what it could do to my career as a coach. And I knew that was an opportunity at the time that was too good to turn down, because at the times the independent schools were looking for more youthful members of staff and coaches, because obviously the old senior pros that are coming out of the game, that are maybe looking for retirement gigs, that are on bigger money, that are not probably got the energy or the enthusiasm, they're at the end of their career. I was the opposite of that. I could, and I'm ever so grateful for Claysmore School at the time in Dorset for seeing that in me and recognising it, and giving me the opportunity. And then, yeah, just sort of went from there, did my level three while I was down in Dorset, moved to a slightly more larger school, which was Sherborne, which was and took the cricket job there, which was, again, it was a bigger move. It was a slightly more prestigious fixture list, but I learnt a lot about life and about the workplace, and you don't realise, I think, how much cricket can institutionalise you. I'd already been aware of not being institutionalised, but yeah, I think that first sort of, it was more the environment I was coaching in rather than the coaching itself that challenged me, that I guess I grew as a person and as a coach as a result of that.
Yeah, and it's interesting for you to hear you say that there was actually an appetite for younger coaches at the time. But in the same breath, did you feel any sort of stigma from any corners about you being a fairly young coach?
Yeah, I think there was a bit of scepticism in the sense that people were probably a bit wary of, okay, well, why is a 22-year-old who should be at the top of his game, peak of his game, not still pursuing that career and still wanting to play? And I felt myself having to justify, more than any sort of imposter syndrome of being a 22-year-old coach and coaching 17, 18-year-olds, yes, that's something you have to get over and you have to grow up pretty fast. I guess it was more the fact that I was looking at it as a... I'm trying to find the right words here for it, really. I think it was more having to justify to people why I wasn't pursuing a playing career, and how could someone who is, you know, only a year or two ago has played at this level and played first class cricket a couple of years ago, and, you know, still can play minor counties if he wants to, and still, I was still in real good touch, and you don't lose it overnight. It was almost that constant justifying as to why I wasn't pursuing that anymore, which it wasn't as easy as just to say, you know, I was pretty burnt out, I'd felt I'd given it enough and given everything I could. But again, just trying to be honest with myself that you have to keep coming back to that fact that, you know, can you look yourself in the mirror and say, I did everything that I could, and at the time where I was, I think I had done by then. So, you know, of course, people, my mates, my colleagues were saying, you know, it's ridiculous, you should be carrying on, and, you know, it's, but they're not in your shoes, I guess. So, but again, I do come back to the fact that I do think the support that the guys have gotten now is far superior when it comes to some of the issues I had. So, yeah.
Tell me a bit more about Tom Flower's cricket coaching then. Why did you feel that your own company was the way to go rather than just being on the coaching staff of a team?
Yeah, I think it comes back to the fact maybe, as I say, having seen the way that counties will treat people at times, and that determination that lightning's not going to strike twice, if that makes sense. So I didn't want to be at the, you know, at the drop of a hat, the beck and call and of a county cricket club again. I'm not sure I could ever face that. I mean, if I did go back into a county, it would be on my terms if I ever went in back as a coach, and it would be very much to suit me. Now, I can almost hear people listening to this thinking that's an arrogant way of looking at it, but ultimately they are happy to be that person and to do what they do for the benefit of what they want to get out of it. So they might be trying to be, you know, furthering their coaching career. They might absolutely do it for the love of coaching and nothing more than that. For me, it's an absolute passion of mine, which I get paid to do. But everyone probably has got a tipping point where if you're not getting paid what you feel you're worth to do, even if it's your passion, you still have to be driven, I guess, financially to want to make a living out of it. And for me, it's dead simple. It's about stability. It's about that regular income, and also being true to myself and getting paid what I believe I'm worth. And counties I don't believe are able to do that to many coaches that see themselves as pathway or academy coaches. They're over reliant on what I call sort of volunteers, people who are giving time. Some people call them tracksuit wearers, you know, whatever you want to call it. And let's be honest, pathways wouldn't run without them types of characters. But when you start talking about this as your full time, not a summer job, not a university job, not a graduate job, not a supplementary income, when it is your full time job and you are coaching in October, November, February, the reality sets in that, okay, a lot of guys will see the county coaches middle of the summer, it's sunny, it's great, they're out, but there's a reality to it, and it isn't all as glamorous as it looks. So look, I guess in short, for me, I can earn a lot more money, I can get a lot more job satisfaction, I can also make more of a difference because I'm coaching and I'm under my own leadership and my own directives, and I can take players in directions that I want and shape them and have a real big impact that I probably couldn't have if I was working at a county right now. So that's never say never on that, I think.
What, in your opinion, makes someone a good coach?
That's really simple for me. I just think just being a good person and just absolute first-class people skills would be the big thing for me. It's a people's game, coaching is, and that ability to relate to different people on a number of levels, those that maybe think they're above you, those that you can get onto a level with, or those that perhaps don't think a lot of themselves. How do you try and get yourself, how do you pick them players up equally, how do you pull players down a little bit? And then, you know, first class communication looks also like how you engage key stakeholders, keeping parents, schools, players all in the loop, so you're all on the same page. But the big thing for me is you have to be a confidence giver, however you do that. And that isn't telling players, that's not necessarily telling players that they're doing something well when they're not. I don't mean that. But to be a confidence giver, you're either, I always think that if a player comes to, if you take improvement and break it right down, you might have a season of improvement, you might have a month of improvement, you might have a session of improvement. So I work on a session by session basis. If a player can leave one of my sessions feeling more confident than they started, then that's progress. And it's not just to say that they have to have a great session, it's not about that. But if they don't have a good session, the art of coaching then is them going away knowing what they need to do and feeling confident in what it is they need to do to get it right. So confidence can be instant confidence, how they're feeling about themselves and how they've done in that session. But also, if they can't have confidence from that, can they have a confidence in what it is they need to get right? And I think that too much of that doesn't happen. And I guess as a player, having had very little of that, I really value that side of it, of making sure that players feel good about themselves and feel confident in themselves, because I think that's the best mindset you're going to have to succeed at cricket. It's a very lonely game, a very isolated game, cricket, and can be a very mentally taxing game. So if I can just offer players 10% more confidence than they came in with, I think that's there's obviously the rest of it's technical game, there's knowledge, but you're saying to me what makes a good coach specifically. I'd hope by level 3 or 4 as I am, you should know how to coach the technical side. So hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think a lot of the things that you've just said apply not only to being a coach, but to being a boss, which you obviously are now with a big team underneath you, including lots of coaches. And I'm sure they've all got their own methods. So I wanted to ask, how much of a hands-on approach do you take to your coaches' methods, or do you allow their individual styles to flourish?
There's absolutely, a coach has to put their individual stamp on things. But there are fundamentals, I think, as a leader, leading by example, setting the right environment, standards, expectations, all things that have been very transferable from my playing days. Preparation, you know, the old saying, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. I do think, you know, don't ask others to do anything you wouldn't do yourself. I'm very old school in that sense. Sweep the sheds, you know. I always say to my guys, there's no job you can do that I've not done myself. Not that I need reminding of that, but, you know, if the bins need putting out, if something needs sweeping up, you get it done. And for me, that's my, I guess I'm an old school leader in that sense. Now, the challenge I often find is there's a modern individual, there's a modern coach, and I've probably got better as I've got older in flexing a little bit when it comes to traditions and standards and things like that. So it's about finding a level and what makes my coaches tick and what their motivations are. But yeah, we have a very simple philosophy at Tom Flowers Cricket Coaching, which is we get the guys working hard, but they enjoy what they're doing. And as I say, they go away with clarity, they go away having improved, and they go away enjoying the game.
And it's not just Tom Flowers Cricket Coaching that you're involved with these days. What other ventures do you have, and why did you think it was important to diversify and offer not just coaching?
Yes, we've got a number of ventures. I've got a group of companies. I've got an indoor cricket centre, Rutland Cricket Centre. We've got equipment and clothing brand, Bespoke Cricket. We also do a business support and advice programme. So I will mentor, which again is a type of coaching, I will mentor business startups. I've worked with cricket startups. I've worked with multi-sports. I've worked with a football company. I've worked with all different types of startups. And that's something I offer, be it an initial assessment and business plan or ongoing support. So again, that's just something that I've found when you group the businesses together to be able to sustain a 12-month a year cricket operation whilst employing five other people, you have to make sure that you diverse if you're going to run it on the scale that we do. But look, it works well. We've firmly positioned ourselves in the top five independent companies in the country. If you're looking at scale alone, I'd like to think reputation as well, but that's not for me to sort of answer that. But yeah, it's a constant challenge, but it's something that, as you say, running a business and also coaching cricket, I do think it's the best job in the world. It's a fantastic way to earn a living and has lots of job satisfaction, I'd say, which is something you don't often hear now.
Yeah, we're almost out of time, but there's a couple more experiences you've had that I'd love to touch on. So you've worked as a coach for England Men's Learning Disability side. Could you talk to me a little bit about what that experience was like?
Yeah, I had 6 years at the ECB. The coaching side was great. I really enjoyed working with some very, what I'd say, marginalised players who maybe have struggled in mainstream cricket or equally are misunderstood in mainstream cricket, but can very much hold their own and have maybe just been looking for a purpose within the game and a place within the game, sorry. So, yeah, the disability side was fantastic. We worked with the learning disability. I mean, I coached guys in there who were playing Premier League ECB cricket, who had played County Second Living cricket, Minor Counties cricket. The array of players that we had in that was fantastic. I did 6 years. I did three tours, I think. Went to Australia, went to Holland, Spain. Fantastic experience. Met some great people. We got presented with a trophy at a test match at Lords and got to do a lap of honour on Sky. That was pretty cool. But yeah, just met some great people and it's really quite humbling. You know, it took me back to why I started playing the game, because you're working with guys there who, half the guys maybe didn't have jobs or weren't able to hold jobs down or weren't able to get employment. And for them, their cricket was their absolute lifeline. And to be part of something that, for me, it was part of my life. For some of the guys, it was their life. And I think that was a really big thing that I took away from that. It was an amazing environment to be in and one of the most enjoyable environments. And I often keep in touch with a few of the guys I was involved with there, and also the staff as well.
And one quick final question. In an ideal world, what does the rest of your career in cricket look like?
Yeah, look, I guess, you know, coaching qualification wise, unless there's a level five that comes out, it's not something that I'd necessarily, you know, I think I've achieved what I want as on a piece of paper, but I don't think I've achieved anywhere near what I want to as a coach. And I think you can always get, I'm excited that I've managed to take my coaching to where it is by 37. Where can I be at 47 or 57? And yes, it's a young man's game, and there's certain physical aspects of it you need to, I'm going to have to tailor and step back on and manage my body, I guess, in the, you know, as I near 40. But what the future holds, I'm unsure. I love what I do. I'd love to continue what I'm doing. And whilst people support that, and our customers and players support that, I'll continue to make an impact daily with you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals every year that we can influence. So longer term, I don't know. Would I take an academy job? As I say, the time would have to be right, and the terms would have to be right. I have no doubt I could the sort of academy role where you're mentoring and fostering adolescents under 18s through that pathway and what it looks like, and because I've been through that and I've seen the other side and I've experienced many of the challenges, I think that's something that I could see my skill set fitting to. But again, it would have to be a very specific circumstance and set of terms for me to do that, because I've built for 10 years something pretty special, I think.
If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to leave us a review and follow us so you never miss an episode.